June 13th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenthal.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back again. We have another wonderful short story from his last bow, some reminiscences of Sherlock Holmes. This one is The Bruce Partington Plans. Ah, more plans are missing, I see, Mr. Doyle. The 40th short story.
Let's rub our hands together, rub our fingers together.
Ah, the 40th short story. This is number 40 on our list of 56. How about that?
Wow, we are getting there. That's crazy. No, I have to say, I love this story. I was really excited when I saw this one was next for many reasons. You guys like this one?
This was a great story.
Awesome.
Yes. I'm with you here. Three thumbs up.
Excellent. So the opening here focuses on Holmes' boredom during a several day period of fog in London. And I went out for a really early run this morning. It was super foggy and that felt just right. So now I really love it when a story opens with like Holmes being bored. I feel like that always signals a good story because I think it means that Doyle is kind of in the mood to play on Holmes's more outlandish side. And so
welcome to day 92 of the stay at home order, Pam. I am getting to the more outlandish list of things to do in my life too.
So, well, and let's see, Steve, which of these things you've done. So on day one, Holmes cross-indexed his huge book of references. Have you done that?
That's all I do, Pam. We talked about spreadsheets. My cross-referencing, my spreadsheet for this vacation is extensive.
I bet. It's probably multiple spreadsheets. Okay.
It truly must be the diary of your life. I can't wait.
Well, you get it.
Too bad you don't have a chronicler, Steve, to put it all together for the readers.
I need a chronicler. Oh, I'm going to put that on a spreadsheet.
So, day two and three, Holmes develops a new passion for the music of the Middle Ages, as people do. And then on day four, I will quote, "My comrade's impatient and active nature could endure this drab existence no longer. He paced restlessly about our sitting room in a fever of suppressed energy, biting his nails, tapping the furniture, and chafing against inaction."
Yes, so, I do that one too. That's totally, that's 92 days right there, tapping the furniture.
Yes. I feel like that's a solid pandemic move right there.
Exactly.
So then he asks, which actually I don't think we should ask, is there anything in the papers? And Watson says, "I was aware that by anything of interest, Holmes meant anything of criminal interest. There was the news of a revolution, of a possible war, and of an impending change of government. But these did not come within the horizon of my companion." And so, again, this is so playful, right? Mm-hmm. And then the two of them chat, as good friends do, about other life choices that they might have made. And so Holmes says, "It is fortunate for this community that I am not a criminal." "It is indeed," said I heartily. And this is something we have seen a few times, right? That idea that like Watson and Holmes talking about, and Holmes would have made a really good criminal. And there's
because
something
he
again.
He studies it so carefully that he could get away with stuff that most people couldn't because he would be so detailed and so careful.
That's his heart of gold. That's what that keeps him from doing that.
Well, and we're going to see a little bit of, you know, criminal adjacent behavior in this very story.
Of course.
And then our second favorite Holmes brother comes walking through the door. Well, first we get the telegram. So I would just pause here to say, isn't Mycroft the best?
Yes, he is my favorite Sherlock Holmes character. I like Mycroft better than Sherlock Holmes.
Why, Steve?
Because he comes in and out of the story and just comes in and explains everything, doesn't need to give the why to why he knows. He just knows. He's the smarter brother. He is the more silly brother. He does silly things that Holmes would not do.
Without the ambition. How about that part?
But we see here in this story that he is very ambitious. He is working. Holmes describes him as he is the British government at this point.
But basically, he's doing something that is, it just meets the minimum standards of what he needs. It's not like it's his passion. He just is good at it. He's just getting
valid.
It done.
Valid. I understand that point.
And I just want to pause here to say that even though Mycroft feels like such a huge part of the Holmes story, he is only mentioned in four short stories and only appears in two. So, Steve, I'm sorry to say, this is the last time you're going to see Mycroft in the canon. He appeared in The Greek Interpreter, as you'll remember, and the Bruce Partington Papers. And then he is mentioned in both The Final Solution and The Empty House as Sherlock is faking his own death. And so, really, he has like an outsized, iconic reputation within the world of Sherlock Holmes, but he's only very briefly mentioned in Doyle's canon. But when he's mentioned, it's awesome, right?
And he is used so frequently in all of the media representations of the canon. Yeah. That's where I think I really adore the character of Mycroft, because so many great actors have played him, Stephen Fry being the latest. I love Stephen Fry's portrayal of Mycroft. I mean, he really loves that character.
And he suffered under a name like Mycroft.
Indeed.
It's British. British people have different names. Chip.
You know, Mycroft and Sherlock are two names that totally go together. So Sherlock is pretty stunned that Mycroft is coming over to 221B Baker Street. He says, but that Mycroft should break out in this erratic fashion, a planet might as well leave its orbit. So it's a pretty powerful moment. And then Holmes asks Watson, hey, do you know what Mycroft does? And Watson says, sure, yeah, he does something in government. You told me that for the Greek Interpreter case. Holmes chuckled. I did not know you quite so well in those days. One has to be discreet when one talks of high matters of state. You are right in thinking that he is under the British government. You would also be right, in a sense, if you said that occasionally he is the British government. My dear Holmes! And exclaims. And then Holmes goes on to say, all other men in the British government are specialists, but his specialism is omniscience. Now, my friends, who do we usually think about when we think of omniscience?
Right. This is absolutely, Mycroft is Sherlock Holmes in a different way that we see. He sees all and knows all, but he does different work with that knowledge.
And this is not unheard of. I mean, I just read a book from Michael Lewis where it was explored. Many people who get involved in government services, they end up specializing in those services, and they may be the only person who really knows that area. That may be the only expertise. We're even seeing it right now with the unemployment computers, the COBOL, where they're trying to figure out, anybody who knows COBOL, please come back and help us, because every one of those machines was designed individually at the time. Mm-hmm. So this seems very much on target with, you know, maybe a brilliant mind like Mycroft, who has a specialty, and certainly everyone becomes to depend upon it. And you can see the risk of it. Mycroft is no longer around. How do we replace him?
Just like when Sherlock was not around, how do we replace Sherlock for those years?
Right. And then when Mycroft comes in, we're reminded again that he's very tall and quite overweight. He's ushered into the room. Heavily built and massive, Watson says, there was a suggestion of uncouth physical inertia in the figure. But above this unwieldy frame, there was perched a head, so masterful in its brow, so alert in its steel-gray deep-set eyes, so firm in its lips, and so subtle in its play of expression, that after the first glance, one forgot the gross body and remembered only the dominant mind.
Oh, Doyle. Oh, Doyle. Wait until you meet the Americans in the 21st century, sir. We're very smart, too.
So American we are, Steve.
We find that this case involves a submarine, the Bruce Partington submarine. That seems kind of important to the military of the time, huh?
Yeah, I was kind of looking up submarines and sort of the history of the submarines. And anyway, we've been trying, the Navy has always been very important to militaries and Britain in particular, because Britain ruled the seas for so long.
And the idea of it by water.
Well, and also, you know, you have the underwater ship is what the submarine is. And it looks like the Royal Navy's first ship was in 1902. So July 9th, 1902, the HMS A1 was launched. And I wanted just to look a little bit about the history of submarines. There was an Irish inventor, John Philip Holland, and he designed the Holland Type 6 submarine that launched 17 May of 1897, so, you know, roughly around this time.
This is written in 1908, just as a reminder. Yep.
That's right. That was purchased by the U.S. Navy on April 11th of 1900. So we have, you know, if we think of maybe Captain Nemo, 1870, when that came out, you know, this idea that submarines were going to be the new ship seems to be right on the forefront. So this seems like it's very timely to be part of a Sherlock Holmes story.
It does talk about Doyle's interest in new technologies, right? Which we've seen many times. And I think it also, there's a little bit, remind me a little bit of the Naval Treaty in terms of, you know, hey, you the reader, we don't need to go too deep into what has been stolen, but it could bring down the British Empire, right?
Less harpoons for this one.
Fewer.
Fewer.
Going on.
I'm sorry. Fewer harpoons. Fewer harpoons for this one.
But anyway, perhaps I misremembered.
Mycroft and Sherlock are really, really working well together here, and their communication is so interesting.
Well, and it's really funny because we got the big brother dynamic, right? We kind of forget that because Sherlock can be so dominant, we forget he's a little brother, 7 years younger than Mycroft. So Mycroft says, "You must drop everything, Sherlock. Never mind your usual petty puzzles of the police court. It's a vital international problem that you have to solve. Why did Cadogan West take the papers? Where are the missing ones? How did he die? How came his body where it was found? How can the evil be set right? Find an answer to all these questions, and you will have done good service for your country." Now, let us pause here, my friends. First of all, he's like, "Sherlock, your usual work is just petty and, you know, you just solve these little police court problems."
Police. Ugh.
Right? But then he asks five questions. And they're the exact kinds of questions that Holmes deals with every day, right? What are the motivations for the crime? How can we find the missing objects? How did this person come to be murdered? How did his body get where it got? And then that final question, how can the evil be set right? You guys, that's all Sherlock Holmes thinks about, right?
And this is why Mycroft came to Sherlock. He knows that that is his specialty. He knows he's the right guy for the case.
In many ways, Mycroft is demeaning Holmes because this is his expertise. And of course, Mycroft is, you know, must be working at a higher caliber and a higher level. But at the same time, you're right. He goes to his brother, his little brother. Brother, solve this for me. Here, you take this little stuff. I'll work on the big stuff over here.
Yep.
And what I think is really interesting among these siblings, which is what makes them so charming, is that Mycroft says, like, Sherlock is like, "Well, why don't you do it?" And Mycroft says, "Listen, I'm an armchair guy." He's smart, as smart as Sherlock, maybe smarter, but he can't do all the bodily stuff. He says, "But to run here and run there, to cross-question railway guards and lie on my face with a lens to my eye, it is not my métier. No, you are the man who can clear the matter up. If you have a fancy to see your name in the next honors list..." My friend smiled and shook his head. "I play the game for the game's own sake," said he. "But the problem certainly presents some points of interest, and I shall be very pleased to look into it." So it's really funny because Mycroft thinks he's bringing this to Sherlock because he can't go around interviewing railway guards and lying on his face with a lens in his eye. But
here, here, I am totally, once again, I am totally team Mycroft on this. Here, here, get some other schmo to go lay down in the railway yard.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
But you guys, even though Mycroft is making that distinction between having the intelligence and then having like the fortitude, the bodily fortitude, but also that charm that Sherlock can turn on, especially with the ladies, Sherlock does the intellectual stuff too. And all of those questions that need to be answered are, we know, the readers of Watson's fine accounts, we know that Sherlock does all that stuff too, even though Mycroft doesn't recognize it.
Yeah. Well, and they both, they certainly have a admiration for each other's skills. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they work as well as a team.
Yes. Yep. Definitely. Yes,
I agree with that. I'll be the oracle. I'll be the one sitting in the basement at my computer. If you have a question, you can call me and then you can solve your little police matter.
Exactly.
There's some more anthropomorphizing in this. We see Holmes once again, the hound imagery being applied to his investigative skill.
Well, and here it's in contrast that when he's on a case, he's like a hound in comparison. See the foxhound, says Watson, with hanging ears and drooping tail as it lolls about the kennels, and compare it with the same hound as with gleaming eyes and straining muscles, it runs upon a breast-high scent. Such was the change in Holmes since the morning. He was a different man from the limp and lounging figure in the mouse-colored dressing gown who had prowled so restlessly only a few hours before around the fog-girt room. And so I think that's wonderful writing.
It's beautiful. We get so much information from that. We understand this guy needs this work. If he does not have the work, he is a totally different person. I think that most of us could really understand that on day 92.
No kidding. I'm like, I need my stuff that stimulates my brain.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. Thank God for Sherlock Holmes, I guess.
And daily podcasting. That's right.
No kidding.
We have a new metaphor for a tricky problem in this one. It's not just a tangled skein this time.
Yeah, I really liked this metaphor. I'll be curious what you think. Let us reconstruct, Watson, said Holmes after half an hour of silence, which, by the way, is a very long time to just sit with your friend while he's thinking something through.
It's meditation right there. That's a meditation moment.
I am not aware that in all our joint researches, we have ever had a case which was more difficult to get at. Every fresh advance which we make only reveals a fresh ridge beyond. And yet we have surely made some appreciable progress. So he's treating the case as if it's like a journey through rugged terrain. So every time you like crest a hill, whew, there's another ridge behind it. I kind of like that.
I enjoy that since I just traveled through the mountains to get to Los Angeles this week. I see that metaphor right in front of me, literally right in front of me out this window. There are mountains.
Through the mountains, through the prairies, through the oceans, white with foam.
I didn't go to the oceans, but the other two, yes, to get here.
Steve, you got to be like 30 miles from the ocean at this point.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe 50. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Time to take a drive a little bit. Go visit your friend the ocean.
There you go. Have her talk to you.
Holmes and Watson are very close now. Seems like a big deal for Holmes to share with Watson the details of Mycroft's work here. Like, I am now going to share in confidence with you. I trust you enough. 40 short stories in and 3 novels, right?
Right. Exactly. Now, and I think there are some scenes, there are a couple of little scenes between them that I want to go over in some detail because I think they're kind of wonderful. So after getting Mycroft's telegram, Holmes says he's going to go out and do some recon. He slapped me on the shoulder with a sudden burst of hilarity. I'm going out now. It is only a reconnaissance. I will do nothing serious without my trusted comrade and biographer at my elbow. That's new, right?
Yeah, that is a totally new concept for Holmes here.
Elbow to elbow, arm to arm. They're going to go and get it done.
Not this time.
You stay here, and the odds are that you will see me again in an hour or two. If time hangs heavy, get foolscap and pen and begin your narrative of how we saved the state. I felt some reflection of his elation in my own mind, for I knew well that he would not depart so far from his usual austerity of demeanor unless there was a good cause for exultation. And so Watson's like, I don't know what he just figured out, but it's good. I can't wait to hear more. As always, Watson is a representative of the reader. But now, like, he's so much more valued than he used to be. And then a few hours later, Holmes sends a telegram. I'm dining at Goldini's restaurant, Gloucester Road, Kensington. Please come at once and join me there. Bring with you a jemmy, a dark lantern, a chisel, and a revolver. S.H. It was a nice equipment for a respectable citizen to carry through the dim, fog-draped streets.
Arm yourself. We got something to do. Meet me at the restaurant.
With yes, a dark this... lantern and a chisel. I mean, it's awesome. So when they go to this like fancy Italian restaurant for a nice little meal, that's where Holmes explains he wants to break into someone's house because Cadogan West's body was, he thinks, put on top of the train by someone, and he thinks he's figured out the place where it might have been put on. Somebody want to read this with me? There's like a little dialogue here that I think is awesome. Could we not get a warrant and legalize it?
Hardly on the evidence.
What can we hope to do?
We cannot tell what correspondence may be there.
I don't like it, Holmes.
My dear fellow, you shall keep watch in the street. I'll do the criminal part. It's not a time to stick to trifles. Think of Mycroft's note of the Admiralty, the cabinet, the exalted person who waits for news. We are bound to go.
My answer was to rise from the table. You are right, Holmes. We are bound to go.
He sprang up and shook Watson by the hand. I knew that you would not shrink at the last, said he. And for a moment, Watson saw something in his eyes which was nearer to tenderness than he had ever seen. The next instant, he was his masterful, practical self once more. This is a touching moment that Sherlock was really inviting him on to this case.
Hey, go do some crime with me. We're going to go break in this house. Yeah, let's go do that. I'm thinking...
We might wind up behind some curtains holding hands. This will be lovely.
We could go to jail together. No problem. We could share a cell. Good Lord.
It reminds us so much of Charles Augustus Milverton, right? So correct. This moment, but like nearer to tenderness than I had ever seen. So like, it's so powerful. And then, but it's like, he has a mask, right? And then he like drops the mask. And so that he's his masterful, practical self. He didn't mean for Watson to see how much it means to him that Watson is willing to break the law for him.
Oh my God. This is
ridiculous. This is where the slash fiction comes from, my friends.
I see it. I get it. But this is, again, this is a wonderful relationship between two people that doesn't necessarily have to have a piece of that relationship being in the dark after the case is over.
Right. But it does. Oh okay. sorry. So, now... Not unusual for us to talk about the means justifying the ends, right?
Yeah, that works out well. Good Lord.
This is, if we are going to save people, sometimes we're going to have to break into places. That's just how it is.
So
what could go wrong? What could possibly go wrong?
I really like how we go through sort of three perspectives on this. So in terms of breaking into this guy's house and finding the scene of the crime. So far we are justified, said Holmes. What do you think of it, Watson? A masterpiece. You have never risen to a greater height.
That is like... Oh my God.
Okay, fine. This might be slash fiction.
Oh my God. You can use that, Steve. Use that with your wife. How was our time tonight? It was a masterpiece.
You have never risen to a greater height.
Now, Lestrade and Mycroft have very contrasting reactions to the burglary, right? Yes. Lestrade is like, we can't do these things in the forest, Mr. Holmes. No wonder you get results that are beyond us. But some of these days, you'll go too far and you'll find yourself and your friend in trouble. And so... I really like that because he's basically saying, that's why you always beat us, because you are kind of extra legal.
So, but, Lestrade, if he was, you know, like, really on his job, I guess he would say, we probably should just have someone watch you all the time so we can arrest you for breaking in and entering. Whatever illegal activity you're doing.
Right. If he wanted to stop him, if he felt that this was outside of the law, he should stop this activity. But but Sherlock gets results.
Instead of consulting him all the time, right?
And what attorney would say, you know, did you get this? How did you receive this information? You broke it. Oh, can we use this as evidence?
It's inadmissible.
Good Lord. Completely.
However, fortunately, Sherlock has his ways of getting the criminal to come forward. So when Lestrade says that, Holmes says, for England, home, and beauty, eh, Watson? Martyrs on the altar to our country. But what do you think of it, Mycroft? Excellent, Sherlock. Admirable. And we all know who has the most power in this society, and it's not Lestrade. So he's justified.
Mycroft says, let's go to dinner.
We get more use of the personals here because Sherlock does put a ad in the personals to get the criminal to show up as he is apt to do. And then we get a little bit of Zen meditation from Sherlock.
Well, I love this, how, again, he uses his big cross-referenced book to figure out how the newspaper has been used. And then he's like, well, guys, I guess we better meet again at 8:00. One of the most remarkable characteristics of Sherlock Holmes was his power of throwing his brain out of action and switching all his thoughts onto lighter things whenever he had convinced himself that he could no longer work to advantage. I remember that during the whole of that memorable day, he lost himself in a monograph which he had undertaken upon the polyphonic motets of Lassus. For my own part, I had none of this power of detachment, and the day in consequence appeared to be interminable. I think, like, I'm Watson on this one. If there's something happening tonight, I can't concentrate on anything else.
I think about this when we watch the murder mystery shows that my wife enjoys. How do investigators sleep at night? If they're in the middle of a case, if they are searching for a suspect, how do they ever rest their mind? I think about this all the time. Sherlock can do it.
Yep. And Sherlock is the only one who can do it because even Lestrade and Mycroft, they're fidgeting in their seats, looking twice a minute at their watches. Holmes sat silent and composed, his eyelids half shut, but every sense on the alert. He raised his head with a sudden jerk. He is coming, said he. You know, guys, when the four men are waiting for the criminal to appear, we've got Lestrade and Mycroft fidgety and checking their watches, Holmes silent and composed. What's Watson doing?
Well, he must be looking at Sherlock longingly.
That's how I'm picturing it, too. You're making a joke, but he's just watching Holmes, I think.
He looks so peaceful
over
there.
There's no other evidence. There's no other evidence. This is one of the problems with the first-person narrator is he forgets sometimes to give us what Watson is doing in a scene because as a first-person narrator, you are observing everybody else in the room and not ever really observing yourself.
Right.
Interesting. Just staring longingly. Oh, look at him. He's so serene.
That's what I'm picturing. Maybe that's wrong.
You know, eventually the gentleman comes in and he admits everything and basically in Doyle's way, just sits down and admits everything and then, you know, fills in the missing places. And I just wanted to throw out, there is a history of espionage right there. And what do we have? Helmuth von Mielke established a military intelligence unit of Germany in 1889. So the Germans, the French, the English, everybody's got their spy agencies going on about this time, and the modern versions of those.
Yeah. Don't mention the war.
Well, the war comes up. The Great War comes up in a few years.
I think I said it once, but I got away with it. Sorry. So we get to the ending of this story. Pam's favorite part. This is really a good ending, isn't it?
Really good ending, right? Yeah. So I'm just going to do the last couple paragraphs. So it is a matter of history, that secret history of a nation, which is often so much more intimate and interesting than its public chroniclers, that Oberstein, eager to complete the coup of a lifetime, came to the lure and was safely engulfed for 15 years in a British prison. And so we've got the criminal is put away. And I like that idea that there's a secret history of a nation. It's only known by people in the intelligence corps.
Mm-hmm. Where's the shadow government when you need it?
Yeah. Doesn't Dan Brown explore that later on?
Sure.
I mean, there's plenty of hidden history stories that have been written. And yes, I like the idea.
Was it Brad Metzler? He also is exploring all that.
But I mean, I think it also points to something deeper. And I'm not saying Doyle wanted to, but he might have. That, like, we only really see the history. You know, when we read history, it's usually of people making decisions. It's of governments. It's of politicians. And, like, what about the real history of real people? I feel like one of the really exciting things about the 21st century is that we're all chronicling our own histories, which means that there's so much that no one can ever process it. But still, we're gathering data that we don't always have about periods in the past.
All those Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds are going to be archives at some point.
Yeah. The internet archive.
500 million tweets that are written every day.
Three people decided to do a podcast during the pandemic. Right. What a wealth of information we've got right there.
The data set is enormous. And yes, there's a lot of garbage data, but there's such a great amount of good data out there that the history books will be very different about this era than they were about any era previous to this, for sure.
Exactly.
You're just assuming there's going to be backup, Steve.
The Internet Archive is keeping everything archived. No worries.
They'll be able to use it against you later on. So.
Well, there is that.
That's what university libraries do now, is, you know, they preserve data.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, now, Holmes finishes his monograph about the polyphonic motets of Lassus, and Watson tells us the monograph has since been printed for private circulation and is said by experts to be the last word upon the subject.
Of course it is.
I have to say, as a one-time music major, I actually, upon reading this story, went and listened to a couple of those motets from Orlando to Lassus. They're awesome, though. They're beautiful.
16th century religious music. That's wonderful. Good job.
Steve, you take the high notes. Come on. Here we go.
But it's,
did Weird Al cover any of these?
Choir. It's polyphonic. So it has very complicated, intricate patterns of counterpoint. And so I'm not surprised Sherlock liked these. These are quite wonderful. However.
Yep, you studied music.
As discussed, we are not all on the same page when it comes to music on this podcast. Now, at the very end, some weeks afterwards, I learned incidentally that my friend spent a day at Windsor, whence he returned with a remarkably fine emerald tie pin. When I asked him if he had bought it, he answered that it was a present from a certain gracious lady in whose interests he had once been fortunate enough to carry out a small commission. He said no more, but I fancy that I could guess at that lady's august name, and I have little doubt that the emerald pin will forever recall to my friend's memory the adventure of the Bruce Partington plan. Who's the august lady, my friends?
Well, if this is the Doctor Who style storytelling, it was certainly the Queen who gave him this lovely pin, and probably a kiss too, if Doctor Who is to be believed.
Oh my. Well, I didn't know about the kiss, but I do think it is Queen Victoria herself, just 6 years before her death, very near the end of her over 50-year reign. She's to die in 1901. So,
God bless Sherlock Holmes. Queen Victoria. God bless him.
This is after she created Torchwood. So
I love it.
This is a
okay.
Great
so
one.
This is a pretty good story, you guys.
Oh,
right?
One of the best.
This is this, and it has all of the elements. It has all of the tropes. It doesn't have a giant info dump. This is quite possibly going to be. We're going to be tied for our favorite of this collection, right?
But there's a lot of layers to this one. And also just, you've got great characters that come through on this. So, and also, the challenges we're dealing with aren't such a much, they're such a grand level compared to what we're normally dealing with.
big. This is a big case with big consequences. I love it. Hope everybody out there is enjoying it as much as we are. Maybe this is your favorite. We would love to hear from you. Tell us about your favorite stories. We are going to get to a wrap-up of these stories in the next couple of days, so we're going to have to put another question out there for everybody to answer. You can follow all of our conversations. Give us a call or an email with your suggestions. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that conversation, and go to our dedicated website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all these conversations. We'll be back tomorrow for the adventure of the dying detective. Oh, that's intriguing. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
Where's my sandwich?